The UW School of Medicine and Public Health and the UW and UW Health were both part of the nationwide effort to study whether plasma can help shorten the duration of severity of complications from COVID-19. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kent. And now that the FDA has approved convalescent plasma for emergency use, we get the latest on the science that started back in April right here. Dr. William Hartman's an anesthesiologist at UW Health and an assistant professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He's leading the effort at UW Health to test an experimental antibody treatment for COVID-19. Dr. Hartman, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So last Sunday, the FDA approved the use of convalescent plasma, emergency use of convalescent plasma to treat COVID-19. But we know some of the COVID patients in Wisconsin have been receiving this treatment already. So what exactly does this declaration mean, doctor?
So in a sense, we were sort of working under an emergency use program when we were under the EAP with Mayo Clinic. Mayo Clinic had a protocol that allowed us to treat COVID-19 patients with convalescent plasma without having to submit a special application to the FDA for every single patient. So it made the process a little bit easier. But there was still quite a bit of administrative burden in terms of how you had to register the patients, how you had to follow up on the patients. And at a place like UW-Madison, we're very lucky to have just amazing coordinators and nursing staff who are able to help us with that burden. Other hospitals, community hospitals, underserved hospitals, they're not able to have that kind of staff to do that. And so what the EUA does is it allowed those hospitals to be able to use plasma without those burdens, those administrative burdens. It freed up the use so that plasma would be available to everybody everywhere.
But you've been using it since April through the Mayo Clinic. And so, Dr. Hartman, how many UW Health patients have received this plasma so far?
We've used it on approximately 55 patients in the last several months.
And when would we likely see more patients receiving this treatment in hospitals throughout Wisconsin?
So it's going to be a treatment that's available to everyone. It's a treatment that many in the community feel is a very safe treatment. And there are clues that it's an effective treatment. And so it's available. All patients should be able to access it if they need it through their hospitals and their providers.
Is there a COVID patient that would need this specifically, doctor? Who would this benefit most likely?
So the patients that benefit the most, according to the studies that are out there right now, and granted, these are not randomized controlled trials, but they are. They've undergone significant statistical scrutiny. The patients that benefit the most are going to be the patients who have COVID-19, are sick enough to be hospitalized, but are in their first 1, 2, or 3 days of hospitalization. So they're not in the ICU yet. They're not on ventilators, where it doesn't appear to be quite as effective. But early in hospitalization, it does appear to have an effect on decreasing mortality.
And you also said that it seems to be safe as well, but are there concerns about convalescent plasma?
In terms of the safety, there's been two large studies that have come out, one on 10,000 patients that receive convalescent plasma and one on 20,000 patients that receive convalescent plasma. And the safety indicators all appear to suggest that this is a very safe treatment. It's very similar to any blood transfusion that's been administered in the hospitals for years. Plasma itself has been used for various other reasons within patients' hospitalizations. And so I think that we had a feeling that it was going to play out very safe, just like any other plasma therapy would. But with those two papers, with a total of 30,000 patients who've received convalescent plasma, the safety indicators are all excellent.
And although it is preliminary and we don't have a full slate of tests or trials, what can you say, Dr. Hartman, about the efficacy of convalescent plasma for COVID-19 patients?
So I think that's really an excellent question, because that's where the controversy really comes in. This was not studied using a randomized controlled trial for various reasons, but regardless, that is the gold standard when it comes to medical research. What we can say is that, you know, there are indicators that it can be effective. The first is that in the paper that was used sort of as the basis for the press conference last week that came out of Mayo Clinic, looking at about 35,000 people who have received convalescent plasma, they were able to see a dose response. And so people who got higher doses of the high titer convalescent plasma, so convalescent plasma with high amounts of neutralizing antibody in it, did better than patients who had a lower titer of neutralizing antibody. And so the fact that there's a dose response indicates that there is some effect there. The biggest issue there, though, is that it wasn't compared to a control group or a group that didn't receive convalescent plasma. That being said, anecdotally, here at UW, we publish a paper, or it's actually, it's under review. It's published as a preprint, but it's still currently under review. On our first 31 patients here, showing that it was effective early, in that when we gave convalescent plasma to patients within a day or two of hospitalization, 94% of those patients were able to stay out of the ICU and off of ventilators and be discharged from the hospital.
Small sample size, but good results of that sample size.
Correct.
Dr. William Hartman is our guest. He's an anesthesiologist at UW Health. Also the clinical trials guy, according to his Twitter post. He's an assistant professor at UW School of Public Medicine and Public Health. And we're taking a look at the latest experimental antibody treatment for COVID-19. And the UW is part of those clinical trials. And last time we spoke here on the Ideas Network, Doctor, UW had launched 3 COVID-19 clinical trials. Like an update here, how many patients were recruited for these trials?
So we're continuing to recruit patients daily. The screening process can be somewhat extensive, but we are looking usually at between 3 and 7 patients every day to enroll in the study. Of that, only a few patients each week actually qualify for the studies and receive the antibody. The antibody cocktail that we are trying out, that we're testing, and this one is a randomized controlled study, and so we don't know if the patients receiving the antibody cocktail or the placebo.
But you referred to this. You're doing the gold standard of test for this, though, correct?
This is the gold standard of test for this, yes.
I'm going to stop you there, Dr. Hartman, but we're going to continue in just a couple minutes' time with more of the clinical trials ongoing here in our backyard with our guest, Dr. William Hartman, an anesthesiologist at UW Health and an assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Be interested in hearing from you. If you have talked to somebody who has had COVID-19 and is recovering, 1-800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Three clinical trials underway to study treatments for COVID-19 and perhaps even a vaccine, all taking place right here, whether you know it or not. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network, and I'm Lee Rayburn. Our guest is anesthesiologist Dr. William Hartman, who's leading UW Health's efforts to test experimental antibody treatment for COVID-19, and he stays with us. And as you were talking, Dr. Hartman, you were doing the gold standard of testing for this and running it through its scientific rigor. But these trials, people are looking for hope out there. And as you are going through the scientific method, do you find it?
So I think that we do. Especially the one we have the most experience with right now is with convalescent plasma. And the fact that we could see patients who previously were not doing well starting to do well after we gave them convalescent plasma, it was exciting for us. It was hopeful for us. We saw people that were getting better and being discharged from the hospital, getting off of ventilators, being prevented from having to go to the ICU and go on to ventilators. It would have been nice to have that the gold standard available in terms of medical research, but we really didn't have that option at the time. And so because when we started up the convalescent plasma program, it was a time when hospitals were shutting down to anything but COVID patients. People weren't working in the hospitals. We didn't have money and we didn't have personnel to really run a randomized controlled trial. So we went with the best that we could. And we started to see evidence that people were doing better. And a disease that had no treatments at the time suddenly had something where we saw people getting better. And that was hopeful. And I hope that we conveyed that, there something here is working. And that spurred on other ideas as to how to go about attack this, one of which is the Regeneron monoclonal antibody cocktail, which is antibodies that they found to neutralize the virus. And they found these in convalescent plasma and in using a mouse model that they have developed at their company.
And this is your other current ongoing clinical trial?
Right. Mm. And so understanding how the convalescent plasma was neutralizing the virus and helping people get better led to these other developments that we're now testing using the randomized controlled trial, placebo control, that is the gold standard.
And in my head, I'm thinking, all right, doctor, let's go. Let's get this going. And then I'm reminded that we are running this through, the scientific method. We are testing this through clinical trials, and we are going to see how this holds up. So give me a timeline for this Regeneron antibody cocktail trial ongoing right now.
So we are in the process of enrolling people. It probably will go, the trial will probably run through the end of fall anyway, and then all the information has to be assessed by the statisticians at Regeneron, and then independently by the FDA if this is going to be approved as a true treatment. The cocktail itself appears to be safe. People don't develop allergic reactions or severe reactions to it, as far as we can tell. And it does look very promising, but we just have to wait for the rest of the data to come in.
And is that going to be months, year?
I it'll be months. Mm-hmm. It'll be a couple more months as we enroll patients and get the medicine into patients. And then because two of the arms, one of them is a preventative treatment and people have been exposed to COVID-19, and the other one is an outpatient treatment, there is a significant follow-up of a month on each of the patients so that we can make sure that they're not having reactions, that they're getting rid of COVID-19 infection, that the medicine is doing what we expect it to do.
Do you have a question about COVID-19? Because we have Dr. William Hartman as our guest this morning, and the phone number is 1-800-642-1234. You can email your questions, ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Hartman's the anesthesiologist at UW Health, leading the trial of an experimental antibody treatment for COVID-19 that we've been hearing about, taking your questions on current treatment and what you need to know about the science here this morning. So we've covered the convalescent plasma, the Regeneron antibody cocktail trials. The third trial would be the phase 3 for a clinical trial for a vaccine of COVID-19. What do you know about this, Dr. Hartman?
With the vaccine trial?
Yeah.
So we just launched this yesterday. We're enrolling people. We need to get up to about 2,000 or 1,600 to 2,000 people involved in the study. And what this is using is the vaccine developed at University of Oxford by the Oxford Vaccine Group, and has gone through phase 1 and phase 2 trials in England before AstraZeneca brought it to test in a larger group here in the United States. And so the phase 3 trial itself will be 30,000 people in the United States and about 50,000 people worldwide. So the goal is to make sure that the vaccine is effective and safe in populations everywhere. The phase 1 and phase 2 trials look very promising. And so we're very, very excited to have this vaccine trial here at Madison so that we can be part of the solution and getting life back to normal.
And Dr. Hartman, are you looking for people to participate?
Absolutely. People who are 18 and older. Right now, the recruitment limit is 18 to 55, but we expect that 55 age limit to extend up to much higher in the near future. That hold just hasn't been lifted yet. So we're limited to subjects who are 18 to 55 right now. We would like population representation from all populations. And so we're extending it to the university community, to the Madison community at large, to the state at large, really. This is a disease that disproportionately affects the elderly and people of color. And so in order to get truly meaningful results, we are going to need representation from all of those groups of people so that we can say that this is a safe vaccine for my family, but a safe vaccine for everybody else's family, too.
Would you just contact UW Health?
Yes, we can contact UW Health. There is a phone number. I don't have it right here in front of me.
We can put it up with the podcast of the interview after the fact, doctor. So if you want to get it to us afterwards, we'll put it up at WPR.org/mornings, and it'll be there for those who are interested in participating in this third phase of a clinical trial. Now, as I understand it, Dr. Hartman, after the phase 3 comes the review from the FDA. So this would be the final clinical trial for this potential vaccine?
Correct. And so this would be the final step that it has to go through. That said, the data has to be followed for a period of time. It's a 2-injection study. So subjects will get a injection on day 1 and then again on day 29. And then they have to be followed to see whether or not they develop COVID-19 or symptoms of COVID-19. Or any other reactions. And so the results are not going to be immediate. And this trial is designed to follow the subjects for 2 years. I think that an answer will come sooner than that. As the data comes in, AstraZeneca is going to analyze it in real time to see if there's a significant difference in the number of COVID-19 cases and subjects who've received the vaccine versus those that receive the placebo. If they're able to detect a statistically significant difference in those, then they will submit the data to the FDA to independently review it and see whether or not they would approve it for use in the general public.
So if we were to look at a timeline of potential, you know, when the earliest we might be able to see an FDA-approved COVID vaccine from the trial underway in our backyard today, what would the timeline look like, doctor?
I still think that the earliest that we would see a vaccine approved is early 2021.
So early next year would be the earliest possibility. And how long will this trial for the vaccine be going here at UW?
So it's an 8-week enrollment. So we'll be enrolling patients or subjects into the study for the next 8 weeks, about 50 participants per day. And this will go on for 8 weeks, but then the follow-up period is 2 years. And so we'll follow these subjects for 2 years so that we can do things like measure their antibody levels and see how long they stay immune competent, really, and have antibodies to coronavirus. We don't have that answer. And so this will be able to help us figure that out.
Hope through science. Dr. Hartman, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you getting the word out.
You bet. Dr. William Hartman's anesthesiologist at UW Health and assistant professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, leading the effort at UW to test an experimental antibody treatment for COVID-19. After the news, we're going to take a look at the sports world and what they're saying about playing a game and more. I'm Lee Rayburn. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. So before playing for the Milwaukee Bucks, George Hill was drafted by the San Antonio Spurs, was traded to the Indianapolis Pacers, onto the Utah Jazz, Sacramento Kings, Cleveland Cavaliers, where he played alongside LeBron James before coming to Milwaukee. It's The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and George Hill could be seen as just an NBA journeyman, until last week anyway. That's when he lit the wick that continues to burn through the sports world today. The Bucks play tonight against the Heat in the playoffs. Game 2, they're already down a game, but they're the ones saying we have more pressing issues to deal with here in Wisconsin. So who are you rooting for? 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest is J.R. Radcliffe. He's a sports reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. J.R., good morning.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
I am very interested in the story about how the sports world stopped in its tracks for a day to say this is not okay. And it started with one Milwaukee Buck, right? George Hill. What happened after that?
Yeah, it's sort of kind of the perfect moment of protest. One of the criticisms you'll frequently hear when a sports figure takes a stand or when anyone takes a stand is that it's premeditated. It's not the right type of protest. There's always accusations that somebody is acting in a way that isn't fully truthful. But really, as we've learned more about what happened when the Milwaukee Bucks decided last Wednesday not to play their playoff game, not to take the floor against the Orlando Magic, is that George Hill really wasn't making it a broader statement. He just was struggling with some of the social justice issues that are going on in the country. Certainly the events in Kenosha on Sunday night, and then subsequently on Tuesday night, prompted him to say, I just don't feel like playing basketball today. I don't feel like today that's the right thing for me to do.
Who of us can't relate to that, JR?
It's true.
I mean, at a certain point, we've got to go work and we've got to go make our money. But man, I just don't know if I can do it today.
I think with him, it wasn't so much, I'm just not feeling up to it. It's more like I feel like we're spending too much time looking at pro sports as this sort of oasis from everything that's going on outside. I mean, literally they're in a bubble in Orlando. We call it the bubble all the time. And I think clearly there was some frustration there that he was powerless to do more. He just said, I'm not going to do it today. I'm not going to play today.
And then the Bucks
initially
said it. And then the Magic said it. And then the NBA said it. And then dominoes.
Yeah, the dominoes just started to fall. I mean, his teammates sort of rallied in support, said, well, if you're not going to play, we're not going to do it either. The Orlando Magic were kind of standing on the floor wondering what was going on. Ultimately, they returned to their locker room. The game was postponed. Other NBA games were postponed. Major League Baseball followed suit. Several NHL followed suit. I mean, there were a lot of major sports teams and figures that were saying, we should sit out too. We should show that we're, in solidarity with this. So it definitely, as you said, the wick – that sort of set things aflame and, sort of showed us that the entire sports world is kind of unified behind this idea of saying, you know, we want there to be action. We want there to be change, and we're not just going to keep playing as if nothing's going on.
Well, some wicks were longer than others, as it did take the NHL about a day, and there was some complaining among the players on the teams about why aren't we joining the rest of the sports world. But I think there is another league that deserves mention, because they have been about as outspoken as I think professional sports has become in the United States, and that would be the WNBA, JR.
Yeah, the WNBA has been at the forefront of this for a long time, and there's a lot of tension. One of the owners, Kelly Loeffler, member of government who has said some controversial things in the past, some things that, you know, don't seem to align with this message of social justice. And the WNBA has been, you know, fighting for this for a long time. And the NBA too. I mean, in fairness to that league, they have sort of been at the forefront of this as well. At least they've tried. There's things like putting messages of social justice on the back of the uniforms in the bubble in Orlando. I think you could view that sort of, you know, sort of say, oh, there it's a big corporate entity trying to co-opt the message a little bit. But the NBA has supported its players. The Milwaukee Bucks organization has supported the movements of its players on this front pretty much across the board. You know, they've allowed them to be themselves and given them a platform and encouraging them to use that voice. So
the NBA
that's encouraging.
Yeah, the NBA had racial justice messages on the back of their jerseys. The WNBA had 7 bullet holes in the back of their shirts when they came out.
Yeah, they're not messing around. No. They want it to be very clear, which is very good.
J.R. Radcliffe is our guest, sports reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And J.R., after the Bucks boycotted their game and the dominoes started to fall, was there any blowback? Was there any professional sports player saying prominently, maybe we shouldn't be doing this?
Yes, there was blowback from, I'm sure, many corners of the world. But I would say that one of the enduring traits of this particular moment is that the sports world really did feel unified. There were not many prominent dissenting opinions, at least within the sports world. And sort of the importance of the statement is the sports world saying, look, we can be united on something like this, and we can wield our power all together. Obviously, these professional athletes do wield a lot of power and a lot of influence. They have a lot of money and a lot of leverage, because if they decide not to play, that is disruptive to, you know, a good chunk of America who are sports fans. So it's different from 5 years ago when Colin Kaepernick was atop headlines. I think there was a lot more. Certainly, there were dissenting opinions, but also just a lot of people who didn't say anything. People who were sort of like, kind of understand where he's coming from, but also, you know, really like sports and don't want it to be that big a deal. Just say nothing. I don't think we have that right now. I think pretty much everybody is saying either strongly, absolutely support what the players are doing, or, you know, there are those who do not. But I don't think there are too many people just standing on the sidelines waiting it out anymore.
So how did this Wildcat strike come to an end? That's the story I haven't heard yet, J.R. Radcliffe. Is there was Josh Hader, relief pitcher for the Brewers, said he thought the season was over when the Brewers had canceled their one game. It sounded like the L.A. Clippers and Lakers had walked away from the NBA bubble and were ready to call it a season. And yet, after a day or 2 days of strikes, they were all back at it again. Do we know the story of how this Wildcat strike ended?
As far as other sports beyond the NBA, I think, you know, Craig Counsell said this pretty quickly for the Brewers, that he did expect them to play the following day. They ended up playing a doubleheader against the Reds when the Brewers wound up sitting out their game on Wednesday. So I guess I didn't see it as a huge chance that we would lose the full sports season for Major League Baseball, for example. In the NBA, it certainly, yeah, it seemed dicier. There's a lot of reporting that's been done as far as the Clippers and Lakers, LeBron James in particular, feeling like perhaps there wasn't a plan in place, that this was a little bit too sporadic, and the NBA wasn't unified. The players weren't unified at the moment that the Bucks decided to do what they did. So he walked out. You know, you can understand it's sort of a rock and a hard place. If you come back to work after 3 days, there's a chance that nothing happens. You know, everyone moves on. You sat out a game, big deal. Now what comes, you know, now what's the fallout from that? But the players did have kind of a heart to heart with owners, and members of the Milwaukee Bucks got on the phone with Wisconsin legislators, with Wisconsin lawmakers to try to sort of encourage change on that front. And the players and owners really sort of came to an understanding about a few things that they would like to see done. Greater emphasis on voting. All NBA arenas are going to be voting places, early polling places now across the country. So that's one big step. And I think I think there was sort of a commitment there from owners. We will support this in financial ways and in meaningful ways that aren't just us saying, yeah, we hear what you're saying and we understand what you're saying. Now there's actual heft behind that.
JR, one of the calls from the Milwaukee Bucks with their strike was that they wanted the state legislature to convene. What we saw on Monday was that the state Senate and state assembly gaveled in. They haven't done anything else, but despite the governor's calls, there was no action for a duration. It was not long after the Bucks stopped taking to the court that the Wisconsin legislature did actually take action.
Yeah, very frustrating. And you heard on Tuesday here, you've heard Kyle Korver, Mike Budenholzer speak to that, say that is really disappointing that the Wisconsin legislature just refuses to take any sort of action. The sort of Republican-led legislature hasn't taken action on really anything since the early stages of the coronavirus pandemic, if we're looking at it in total. But I certainly thought that could impact what the Bucks did on Monday night in game one of their Eastern Conference semifinals. I wasn't sure they were going to play. I mean, it doesn't sound like there were a lot of rumblings. No.
Whether or not they played Monday night is an open debate, JR. We've got game two tonight, and you've got 2 minutes to talk about it, because the Milwaukee Bucks, before the pandemic, were the NBA's best team. I don't think there's a debate about that. But the Milwaukee Bucks inside the bubble, it's been a struggle. They're down a game in a best of seven series against the Miami Heat. They tip off tonight at 5:30. Are they still a favorite?
I think you had to come into this series understanding, certainly I'd call them a favorite, but definitely didn't expect them to dominate this series. Miami matches up well as any team in the league. Legitimately could be the worst matchup, although it's hard to say. I think the other two Eastern Conference teams are really good too, but Miami has played them tough, beat them twice before the stoppage, and then really hammered them in the first half inside the bubble in a seeding game, and the Bucks were able to roar back in the second half. But they pose major matchup problems. They can shoot the ball very well. They have a defender named Bam Adebayo and others who have been able to keep Giannis in check, and that's certainly something most teams cannot do. So that is an issue. Now, you could point to a couple things. The Bucks were without Eric Bledsoe, who is a really big key cog in their defense and is their starting point guard. And that's something that getting him back is definitely going to help their cause. And they've struggled in game one here before. They lost game one of the series with the Magic. They lost game one of their Eastern Conference semifinals last year.
Yeah,
they were able to bounce back. So you got to hope that that's what's going to happen again.
One word answer here, JR. Are you ready for some football?
Sure, absolutely.
JR Radcliffe is sports reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and that's where we're heading next. NFL season set to kick off in a little more than a week away. Are you ready for Green Bay Packer football, and what will it look like this year? We'll take you to the scene when we continue and take your calls at 1-800-642-1234. Are you proud of your Milwaukee Bucks? What should they do next? Win tonight would be a guess. You're listening to the Ideas Network. It's set to be an eerily empty U.S. Bank Stadium in the heart of Minneapolis at noon, a week from Sunday, as it plays host to the Green Bay Packers' first game of their season against the Minnesota Vikings. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell said yesterday that all end zones across the league all season will read "End Racism" on one end, and "It Takes All of Us" at the other. You have to wonder what Colin Kaepernick is thinking this morning, and you as well, at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Our guest is a sports reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, J.R. Radcliffe. And J.R., no preseason football games this year, which seems to be the first thing that people complain about with the NFL every year.
It is true, but it is surreal to think that the NFL season is going to just be here in a week. Week one, without any sort of ramp up. You know, we spend usually 4 weeks, a month of the year, analyzing who the 53rd guy on the roster is going to be and which undrafted tight end out of a college we haven't heard of is going to make the roster. And now we're going to skip all that. We're just going to go straight ahead to NFL football. It's going to be a very jarring thing for a lot of us.
Well, but we get right to the meat. We jump right into the heart of it. We don't even have to put up with any of the banter. We can just get to kick off and tackle.
It's true. And I think whether or not the Packers win that first game will dictate how Packers fans feel about that. They'll be fine with it if they win. Like, yes, this is exactly what I wanted. And if they lose, it'll be like, well, we needed at least two preseason games, maybe three.
Such is the law of the Green Bay Packers. But they, along with other NFL teams, were part of the Wildcat strike and across the world of sports last week. They canceled their practice at a time where, as you allude to, JR, they could desperately use all the practice they can get. Instead, they had a conversation about racial justice. What do we know that about what took place inside the Packer locker room?
Again, I think it fits with what we were talking about earlier, sort of this unified front across the sports landscape. And the Packers were not the first team to cancel their practice. That was the Detroit Lions who did that. And more than that, understandably, practice isn't going to get as much headline attention, as much attention overall as trying to sit out a playoff game or a regular season game. So the NFL football season just wasn't in position to make that statement. But it's obviously interesting on a couple levels. If the NFL decided to sit out a regular season game, that would carry as much impact as any of this. Certainly on par with a playoff game in another sport, because there's only 16 of them, and the NFL is king in this country. And to see that sort of statement would be massive. And we have to think now that they're capable of doing that. We're also talking about this league where, like you mentioned, Colin Kaepernick 5 years ago, you know, I wouldn't say he was shouted down by the NFL by any means. There were a lot of players that supported his decision to kneel for the national anthem. But for the most part, the NFL didn't rally to his defense. They were not out there painting messages in the end zone to try and support him. You know, he was mostly certain, you know, he still hasn't been on a roster. Like, he's been sort of blackballed from the league to a degree. Maybe that's too strong, but the NFL wasn't in his corner the way that they are now. Things have changed, and the NFL is sort of, you know, maybe tepidly, you could say, but they are along for the ride, and they're willing to listen far more than they were when Colin Kaepernick tried to bring these issues to the forefront.
Who does Roger Goodell speak for? Because that would be the changing face of the NFL over the last 5 years, from Colin Kaepernick to the etched in end zones of this coming season. What's his perspective?
His perspective is, I want to make the owners happy, and the owners are happy if the bottom line is good. And, you know, if you're on the wrong side of an issue where the majority of your fans have started to, you know, gather in chorus saying, we feel like there's something wrong, we respect that the players are going to make a statement, then he's going to probably side with them if he feels like that's the, you know, that's the prudent thing to do. I don't mean to sound cynical about it, but I just feel like that's sort of been borne out over time. That's what Roger Goodell's representation is the ownership team of, you know, the National Football League. But I mean, he could be a powerful ally if he's on board, whether or not his intentions are pure. It's a valuable asset to have, because he obviously wields a lot of power and a lot of influence. And if people think, you know, if there's a concern that the NFL could sit out games, that's, you know, going to dramatically impact the life of a sports fan, the average sports fan. And that's something that, you know, that could be very useful in this, you know, quest for social justice.
It would be better serving for the NFL to do an about face about Colin Kaepernick taking a stand than it would be to lose an entire week of the NFL season.
Absolutely. Yeah. It would. I don't think you'll see that. I mean, I think that they'll feel like that's water under the bridge. They'll not want to revisit what at this point looks like an error in judgment, an error in being willing to back someone who had some very important things to say that we all needed to hear. And 5 years later, it looks pretty stupid that people weren't listening to him.
J.R. Radcliffe from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, our guest here. And J.R., this is a good question from Jeff from Fox City. I don't know if you'd be able to tackle it, but he's wondering about the effects of the pandemic and the protests on sports viewership. Do we know what, are we watching the NBA playoffs like we used to?
Yeah, I would say sports viewership is okay. There's been a little bit of a drop for the NBA, actually a pretty significant drop for the NBA year over year. But some of that is, you chalk it up to just the strange schedule. No one was watching the NBA in August and September last year because it wasn't on TV. There's a lot of, you know, right now there's a lot of uncertainty in our lives, so it's very difficult to really get a handle on viewership numbers. But the NBA is concerned about it, that there's been a drop in viewership. It seems like it may even predate the pandemic to a degree. Overall, I don't know if there are a whole lot of judgments being made at this point because, you know, because everything is just so weird. The schedule is weird. Our lives are weird right now. I think there will probably be a little bit more consternation about that as, you know, knock on wood, as things start to return to normal.
Well, JR, one of the things that'll be weird for me is to see NFL games in empty stadiums. And I think, you know, and I don't mean to make light of it, but I can imagine baseball in empty stadiums because we've seen the Tampa Bay Devil Rays. It's but seriously, though, part of that energy, part of that, you know, is got to be the crowd. And to think of the U.S. Bank Stadium in the middle of Minneapolis hosting the Green Bay Packers and the Minnesota Vikings, and all you're going to have is that Viking call and no response, it's going to be strange.
Well, piped in crowd noise. That's been the accusations for Minnesota for years.
That's right.
It's going to sound like a totally normal game. I don't know what you're talking about.
Are they also going to virtually put in the crowd in the seats like they started to do on Fox and the MLB? That was a video game.
That was weird. Yeah. That was so weird. Uncanny Valley, hard to cross in that case. Yeah, I mean, it is going to be weird. I personally think this just comes down to personal taste. I personally initially felt that it didn't take long for me to overcome the idea that there was no one in the stands. You know, there's obviously a jarring initial wave, and then you sort of come to terms with it. It's fine. It makes sense. The NBA, you don't even see on the main camera view. You don't even see the crowd the way they have it set up. So that certainly helps. And with the NFL, I think initially it'll be weird. I find the more I watch baseball, actually, the more I'm sort of noticing it, because you sort of, you know, I've seen enough baseball where it's not like, man, I just would love to see, you know, the fans react to a home run or hear an authentic crowd roar when a big play happens. You're starting to miss those things.
But I saw the story yesterday, JR, and it's not so far away that I didn't take notice that the Iowa State football team is planning to have 25,000 fans in their seats for their games this season. And
yeah, and they're plan is being called pretty reckless too by some health officials.
Right. So what's weirder, an empty stadium at this point or a full stadium considering the world we're living in today?
Yeah, I still think it'd be weirder to see an empty stadium. When it's half full, you'll still hear a roar. You'll still have some of those cues. You'll see people cheering. So it'll be weirder to see an empty stadium for sure. But, you know, I don't think we have to call it a new normal. I think we all imagine and expect and hope that this is still a short-term situation, even though it's longer term than we thought it was going to be. But sports fans will come to terms with it. If they can see sports on their TV, they will ultimately make that concession.
So I've given you 30 seconds to preview the Packers season, J.R. Radcliffe. I'm sorry, but what are you expecting from our pack this year?
It's a puzzle. Part of it is not having a lot of information because of COVID. Part of it is the Packers division isn't particularly strong. The Packers went 13-3 last year, but most onlookers will tell you they got all the breaks, that they probably aren't as good as their record indicates. But and a lot of the same faces you saw last year are here this year. There isn't a lot of mystery in the starting lineup. So it's going to be the team most people are familiar with. Whether or not that pays off, I still think that's a playoff team. I think that the division, they are still headed to the playoffs if, you know, assuming they don't have a lot of major problems with injury and whatnot.
J.R. Radcliffe, thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Sports reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And just ahead, we'll have an hour-long discussion about dyslexia. We'll take the time to explore our own perception and the lessons that people with dyslexia have to impart to all of us. I'm Lee Rayburn. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.